Todd's on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Andrew Merrifield has written a new book that chronicles the journey of the soul he took with a donkey named Gribouille, called The Wisdom of Donkeys, Finding Tranquility in a Chaotic World. In the bucolic region of southern France's Haute-Auvergne region, Merrifield finds himself as well as ponders life's larger mysteries. Gribouille contributes as well as the two consider science, beauty, nature, literature, and truth. Andrew Merrifield was born in Liverpool and has taught geography at British and American universities. The author of four previous books, Merrifield lives in France, where he joins me now. The book is published by Greystone and retails for $22.95. It is a pensive and thoughtful book. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Andrew Merrifield. Good morning, Professor Merrifield.
Thank you. It's no longer professor, I have to say. I did quit academia several years ago, but it's a very nice introduction, and I'm very happy to be here.
This is a very interesting book because it is, it seems to be more than just about the donkey or donkeys. It's about yourself. It's about where you live now, France. It's about all these things, this confluence of things that come together. What compelled you to write the book?
What compelled me to write the book? That's an easy and difficult question to respond to. The donkeys were the primary motivation. Seeing donkeys really for the first time in fields in the wild. I was riding my bike. I remember very vividly one occasion several years ago when I first arrived in this region. When I was riding my bike up a mountain and I stumbled across a group of donkeys, and there were a beautiful view over the valley, and I stopped and I was looking at donkeys, and I found myself just compelled by these creatures, so tranquil, so peaceful. Their eyes just captivated me, full of melancholy, full of some kind of meaning, and the more I looked at these creatures, the more I felt myself thinking about, my mind was wandering and thinking about all sorts of things that I never thought about for a long time, and I started to engage in kinds of reverie and daydream, and all flooding memories came back, and I remembered the time when I was actually very young in the north of England on vacation with my parents at a resort called Blackpool Beach Resort, and I used to ride donkeys at that moment, and I guess back then I must have been about 5 or 6 years of age, and all these memories came flooding back because of something about these creatures were speaking to me, and that was the epiphany moment, if I can use such a dramatic term, that happened to me.
You write in the book a proverb that when you watch a donkey, don't forget your chair. They seem, I guess more than any other animal, they seem animals that seem to demand that you watch them, I suppose.
This the epitome. They exude this peaceability, this passivity, this placid demeanor. You're there and you're looking, and they're shuffling around. You can just hear this faint rustle. The noise is very different from listening to horses in a field, or even listening to cows graze in a field, or sheep or goats. And you just hear them shuffling around, moving around. Very, very precise movements, wonderfully dainty legs, and their hoofs just move, and they delicately place their feet. And it just is this mesmerizing creature to look at, and it's just full of some kind of deeper philosophy that I wanted to find out more on. It was a book that was provoked by me wanting to find out more about the donkey, and in so doing, I felt I was discovering forgotten aspects of my own self through the eyes of a donkey, and it turned out to be a book that included a lot more of me than I originally anticipated.
Talk to me about this journey that you set on. Was it just, this all took place after you'd left New York City and left academia?
Yes, that happened a good few years afterwards. The story is a longish one, rambling and full of meanders, but to cut a long story shorter, I was basically tired of academia, and my wife and I were a little tired of living in a big city, actually were living in New York on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And we were just exploring the idea of a change. We had ideas that we wanted to perhaps to move back to Europe, but not to move back to the UK, where I'm from. And then my wife had a chance to work a temporary job in Geneva. So we lived near the Swiss border for a couple of years. And then it was pretty much where I discovered seeing donkeys in the field when we were in the French countryside seeing them. And then a little while later, we decided to move to this region in the Auvergne. And donkeys kept appearing. And it was then that I got interested in donkeys. And then it was that moment when I thought I'd like to perhaps just write something about them. And the research then became finding out more about donkeys, trying to understand these creatures, because I was a complete amateur. I knew nothing about them, really. I'm a lifelong urbanist to that point, really, an urban person. In fact, my academic career was based on writing about cities, so I was a complete novice. So I wanted to find out more about the physiology of these animals, more about their behavior, more about whether, in fact, they were as dumb as their reputation goes. And so I spent some time in the UK, in the south of England, at the Sidmouth Donkey Sanctuary with donkey experts. And I learned a lot. And I came into contact with a small organization, a small enterprise in this region who have donkeys. And I spent a lot of time talking with the guy who runs that company, that enterprise, and I learned a lot from him. I read a lot, and then the objective was how would I write a book and what would structure it. And then I had the idea of doing a walk with a donkey, a slow walk over a long distance, over a long period, and that would be the basis of the narrative. The narrative would be would be motivated by the daily walk, and in between it was just a question of how I could talk about donkeys. And then progressively I discovered that I was talking about myself, so that was pretty much how the book came to be, piecemeal and a lot by chance. And nothing really more I could say than that.
You lived in Manhattan. In the book, you write that it had always been a dream of yours to live in New York City. You ended up living there, and you taught there. You just said you lived on the Upper West Side, but you grew tired of it eventually. Why?
Stress, ambition, lots of people, lots of noise, lots of action, which hitherto had very much inspired me and very much animated my life, almost, really, just became too much. Too much isn't quite right. I write in the book that it became a realization. I was, in fact, underwhelmed by it all, that this stimulation was something that was giving me almost a false sense of animation. Behind it all, my life was lacking in something. I wasn't quite sure what it was, but I was tired of teaching. I wanted a change, and my wife felt that she needed a change too. So it was really by chance that we came to France. Why we got tied in Manhattan is difficult to talk about with any precision, but it seems like most of the people I knew, most of my friends who still remain very good friends, all tied in Manhattan, and they want to leave, but most people never do. I remember seeing a very amusing film several years ago with Lou Reed was interviewed, and Lou Reed, the singer, said, you know, that he's been trying to leave Manhattan for 40 years, but he just can't make it. And I think that there is a zeitgeist of New Yorkers that has this love-hate relationship with their city, that it's driving them crazy, but they can't quite leave. And so for me, it was slightly different. My allegiances were much more, much looser than that, I think. I was always somebody who was an immigrant in an outsider in the United States anyway. You never felt quite at home. So it was a move that didn't seem so difficult to do. And yet, at the same time, I do have nostalgia for the city, and I do, I think, know the city quite well. So I was always writing about donkeys and writing about open fields and peace and tranquility in rural France through the lenses of how might my friends react to this book, how might urban dwellers react to this book. Is there something in this book that they could take reading on the New York subway or reading on any urban subway, bus somewhere? And so I was quite conscious of to whom I was writing, in a sense, and I didn't want to make it just another nice, romantic, fairly predictable English person writing about France, if I can say that. I wanted to appeal to a slightly different audience and perhaps make it talk very honestly about somebody who did enjoy living in cities, but now has made another move and tried to make it responsive to that shift and why that shift came about. And here I am now, feeling a lot freer and a lot happier, and why that might be. And so I guess my book tried to work that through. And the pace, the gentle pace of the walk and the constant stopping with a donkey, they tend to stop and eat a lot, punctuated some of these reveries, some of these retrospective drifts that I had in the book, and try to appeal to a readership that may not just be people interested in reading about donkeys or indeed reading about rural France.
You live in the Auvergne region in rural France. Is it an isolated place? I mean, how far is your closest neighbor?
Closest neighbor is not too far. Where I live is what the French would call a hamlet, which is one step down from the village. There's a village which is about a mile and a half away, which has, it's a fair-sized village with about 200 people. The hamlet itself, where I live, has myself and my wife and my young daughter and about six other inhabitants. So it's pretty small. There's a bigger town, which is Clermont-Ferrand, which is a larger town. It has a factory that makes, it's quite well known for making Michelin tires for automobiles, and that's about an hour away. Paris is by car, is about 6 hours north as the crow flies. The Mediterranean is about 3.5 hours to the south. To the east, you could be in the Alps, in Geneva, in about 3.5 hours. So it's quite close to lots of places, but indeed it's really nowhere. One could say it is isolated. But that sometimes is a state of mind anyway, and isolation is something that seems much more of an issue when you're looking into this village. But actually, once you're here and you connect and you make friends and you begin to appreciate and understand how things are done here, then I feel no more isolated than I did in New York, except the fact that there's no delivery of pizza or things like that, so you do have to be quite organized, and people go to bed rather early, so people close their shutters generally, like for example this evening, around about 6 o'clock in the evening, and the day is effectively done, and then it's nightfall and it's very quiet. So it's that perhaps is the big difference, is the quietness.
And in terms of raising your daughter, that's the ideal place for you?
Again, that was by chance. It wasn't a choice that we consciously made. It just seemed to happen, like most of what has happened to my life, by chance. Not really through some sort of premeditated plan. The idea was that it would be, the idea is that it would be a nice place, a safe place to raise a kid, providing that we can expose her to the bigger world too, that we can show her places that we know. I still keep in contact with friends in the US, and I'm still in the US on a fairly regular basis. My wife travels a lot, so I've been traveling with her. So we're opening her out to a bigger world, and the idea would be that she can go to local school here down the road, which would be nice, that she would be brought up bilingual, which would be nice, and we can expose her to various things that interest us in our life, it still do, and she can make her own decision when she gets older. So it wasn't a conscious decision to flee the world and to have a child raised in a very protected environment. It, how it's happened is purely by chance, and we're just going to go from there, really.
Back to this walk that you talk with Gribouet, the slow walk, you call it. How long did it take? Was it something that you set out to do?
Oh, a long time. That's a little bit of my secret. I was walking for a long time, over a long distance. But in the book, I wanted to try and get away from specificities of particularly time. It's clear that in the book, there are places named that are real places that exist on the map. The order of some of the places I visited wasn't exactly the order of the voyage itself. But more than that, I wanted to really somehow get rid of all specific, what you might call empirical locations of time and space. That I wanted to travel in a dream world, and so the narrative shifts. The voyage itself was real, but I wanted to convey it as a dream life that may or may not have happened, that could keep people perhaps dreaming. If it was too specific geographically, it would become a standard travel log, which I didn't want. If it became too standard a narrative of what I did each day, the next day in the morning I did this, and the day after I did this, it would be, again, a rather sterile, linear type of book, and I wanted to try and destabilize that and do something a little different, do something a little dreamier, and perhaps a little bit more phantasmal. And it didn't come completely easy at first. I had to rewrite it a lot, and I was struggling to find the voice, struggling to find the tempo, struggling to find the speed. The donkeys go slow. A slow book could be actually a rather boring book. The constant stopping could actually in some way inhibit the flow of the narrative, could inhibit the flow of the stream of consciousness that I wanted to capture in the reveries. The structure of the book did cause a little bit of difficulty at first, but whether I got it right in the end, I'm not sure. But I did want to make it a dreamy voyage through a landscape that is at once real yet irreal and make-believe, through a time which could be just the passing of a reverie that one has in the space of a daydream on a New York subway, as I say at the end. So that was the basic narrative intent and the desire to write a book that was about France, but about something else other than rural France.
Did you own Gribouet?
No, he was a donkey that was completely borrowed from a person who became a friend, who has his own business called Small Business, where he rents out donkeys to walkers, often to families with young kids who don't really walk very far, and they just have fun with donkeys because donkeys are very kids friendly, and kids love to pat donkeys, and donkeys are very, very gentle, and never in any way, or very rarely would they bite or do they kick. So they're good animals to go walking with young kids. So I borrowed Priboy, who's an elderly donkey, a rather large donkey, a very strong donkey, and it was thought that he would be the donkey that would be best, and I fell in love with him when I first saw him, and it was an instant attraction really to this donkey, and we took it from there. So it was not my donkey, and it was a heartrending occasion when I had to give him back, actually, as I described a little bit in the book, because after being on the road with the donkey for a number of weeks, you begin to become quite attracted and quite contented in his company, and I hope vice versa.
And in terms of communicating with the donkey, perhaps giving it direction or asking it to go places, that was easy.
That depends on the donkey, and it depends on the partnership that one develops with the donkey. All donkeys have their own personalities. Donkeys have a reputation of being stubborn, a little bit hard-headed. We've seen many, many bumbling scenes of donkeys, people trying to push donkeys, trying to pull, and they don't budge an inch, and people are miffed by and curious, perplexed by this kind of behavior, hence the reputation. But behind the donkey mind, often there are good reasons, not necessarily logical reasons, for why they behave in such a way. But the point being is you need to get into that brain, into that donkey mind, and each donkey has its own mind and its own behavior patterns. And it took a little while before I felt I was understanding Gribbley, and he was understanding what I was wanting to do. But quite honestly, after several days, he knew by a tug of the lead rope what I was asking him to do. He clearly became conscious of my voice. And we spoke in French donkey, so he became aware of my accent, and he became aware of my voice, that his ears would raise when I shouted him, when I spoke with him. I nudged him here and there because I wanted to change direction, I'd pull. He decided he wanted to stop, so we had this reciprocal arrangement whereby I would move. I'd pull him because I wanted to change direction. He'd stop because he'd seen something very edible on the floor that he wanted to eat. And it was give and take. And we began to get into a rhythm, and it was clear that after several days we did have a rhythm, and it was this give and take rhythm that really punctuated our day. And there were times when he didn't want to move, and he stopped. And the question then is, when a donkey stops, often there's a very good reason why he's stopping. So why was he stopping? What could I do? I'd check his feet, whether perhaps there were problems, there were bits of pebbles that had gathered in his bottom of his hoof. Other times I just went with the flow, and that was moments when I went with this donkey who was just staring out into a forest. For me, I could see nothing other than trees and utter silence, and the donkey was there, mesmerized by something. I didn't know what, but then I just stopped and waited with him. There's nothing else to do. He's not going to move. I just got to be patient, and that often happened, and I found that those moments of what seemed to be frustration, or what could have been frustration, and the owner perhaps, or the walker, becoming impatient, were very fecund and very the moments when that is the meaning of what a donkey is, and hence the notion of slowness, hence the notion of tranquility, hence the notion of going at a donkey's pace. And that became for me this metaphor. How perhaps one could live a life, and how one could slow down and go at that pace and be a bit more patient, more peaceable, more tranquil in oneself, and develop a potentiality to daydream in a world that the daydream is really more and more inconceivable for busy people hitherto, including myself, I have to say, because this book is not meant to be a preachy book about how to live your life. It's meant to be an honest account about how somebody's changed and how the donkey had helped reveal certain things that were in my in my head already that when able, I wasn't able to express, and by expressing it in a book, I felt it was helping me come to terms with some of the problems I had in my own life in the past.
Was it a transformative experience for you?
Certainly was a transformative experience, yeah. I was on the way before then, but it was something that reinforced that there are other ways to live, there are other ways to think about the world, the world seems to be constantly warring everywhere, and here is an innately peaceable animal. Everybody seems to be going faster and faster, and again, that was my life in Manhattan. Here is a donkey that's going very slow at its own speed, not really pushed around. That is very, very present, and donkeys are very, very aware of the environment, what's around them. And one thing I began to notice is just how unaware people are of where they are, because they're somewhere else in a conversation on a cell phone, or they're so busy to really look around where they are that we're missing everything. And I plead guilty on that account. I just think that the donkey helped me nudge along this transformation that was already in place in my life at that specific point before I embarked upon writing the book.
And those questions that you ask of yourself, who am I, why am I here, where do I come from, where am I going, you settle some of those questions over the course of your journey?
One can negotiate them, let's say. Those questions are always to be negotiated, I think. They're never answerable definitively. One negotiates them, poses the question, one reflects upon one's life, where one is at a certain time, and they're never definitive answers. It's folly to just try to find a definitive answer. It's a question of posing the question almost, and reflecting upon the question, finding time to think about the question, to ponder on the question, and that isn't always easy. But the answers are always to be negotiated in how best a way one can negotiate them.
In terms of how you write, Andy, where you live, you're able to, you have the comforts of technology that you're able to write on a computer. Can you?
Oh yeah, it's an isolated rural place, but it's not on the moon's surface. It has a computer connection, an internet connection, which is reasonably rapid now. It's not the fastest, but it's rapid enough to stay online, to communicate, to send emails to people, mainly to editors and to my agent, who's actually the same coast as yourself in California. So I keep in touch by email. Technology's there. I'm not by nature a big high-tech person, but obviously a computer and an internet connection and email is indispensable to live here, to live the way I do. How I write, I write on a computer. I often write by hand. More and more I write by hand, and then I maybe tap it into a computer and rewrite it on a computer. Sometimes I just write directly into the computer. It depends a lot on the kind of stuff I'm writing about. But I probably write no differently from how I did write on the Upper West Side of Manhattan with a little Macintosh laptop and an email and internet and a pen and paper, and that's how it goes. What I do have, which is a blessing, is a very peaceful environment to write in, which is ironic because in the past I've always been motivated by urban environments. I've read a couple of books about urban issues, and living in either London where I lived and living in Manhattan.
In terms of writing this book, did you, when you started it, did you set out to write this for yourself, or did you intend to write this for a reader, or a particular kind of reader, I guess your friends in urban life, I suppose?
For myself, originally, I would say, to begin with, it was a book that was motivated for myself. And in fact, when I sent several drafts to various people to look at, the publishers were not so interested in it, I have to be frank. So it was a book that I was writing for myself because of a genuine interest in donkeys, a genuine desire to write about them, to research, do some research about donkeys. And a good way to research is to write things down, and the book began to take shape. And then I found that I was writing parts about myself. And bit by bit, then there became an awareness that this was a book that might have a readership. Who am I speaking to? To whom am I speaking? And then it became clear that this is a story that may be of interest to perhaps people like myself, people who live in cities. The New York references are not done rhetorically. They're done because it's a city that I do know, and it was a point of reference from my life, to some degree still is. So the allusions to New York were genuine, a genuine allusion on the basis of that was a place where I'd lived, that's a place I know, that's where a place my friends were, that was where eventually the publisher was going to publish the book, the original, the US version of the book. And so it just seemed to then fit nicely that why not address these kinds of people, real people that I know or abstract people that I sort of know.
One last thing, Andy, the reaction to the book, has it been favorable thus far?
It's a little early to say, I think, the general reaction of the public, because I think the book...
I mean in terms of, let's say, people who've read the book, friends of yours, your wife, perhaps.
Oh, my wife is always very critical of everything I write, but in a very tender, kind, positive sort of way, and... she's been critical of my other books in the past, but she loves this book. So I've got it. I've managed to get it past my wife, who's always my staunchest critic. Other people seem to like it. The people who I have to say are rather biased in favor of me, editor and agent and family members. But apart from that, not too many people up to this point have read it. So. We'll just see how the public reacts to it. I hope it might provoke their interest into donkeys, because it is a book about donkeys. It's a book about more than donkeys. It's a book about France. It's a book about tranquility. It's a book about how somebody's changed, hopefully for the better. It's a book about self-discovery. It's a book about all these several things that people themselves might be interested in, and you know, if they can get interested in donkeys, perhaps they can discover the world that I discovered through the lens of a donkey, and hopefully that's the best I can expect.
Well, Andy, it's been delightful to talk to you today, and I do congratulate you on writing this book. It's a fascinating and interesting book, and thanks again, Andy.
Thanks for having me on the show. Okay.
In our fast-paced and loud world, this is an ideal antidote to urban life and all that, and it's a fairly interesting book on donkeys and remarkable indeed. Andy Merrifield is the author of The Wisdom of Donkeys, Finding Tranquility in a Chaotic World, 2295, published by Greystone. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Plata.